There was something strange and quite wonderful to realize that a religious practice, a spiritual practice like Buddhist meditation, cannot just be profound, but so fun and joyful. And it's just like sometimes when people come to visit monasteries, Buddhist monasteries, they get surprised. So when they see a group of monks hanging out together and just laughing their heads off. What's going on? I thought you were supposed to be serious. Yeah, we're seriously having fun. And that was an important part of my journey in spirituality, to realize that if this path was worth anything, it should bring you a very simple, easy joy, a happiness which was very real and you could see when you interacted with good monks or good nuns. A sense of not being so proud, you didn't want to laugh, being easy enough to laugh at your own faults, to see the joy in nature. Oh, just sometimes just remembering some of the times when you see birds in the forest, when they just go into the, you keep little water baths there for them, or especially when there's not many places to bathe, and to watch them and just sometimes falling in there when they lose their balance, even parrots losing their balance. In other words, sometimes I'm not sure what they're thinking, but sometimes you realize that even animals, just they have a bit of like, well, not shame, but they get embarrassed. I always remember years ago, just in Bodhinyana Monastery, in the forest there, seeing a couple of kangaroos just go, no, not out of fear, just peacefully jumping past. And as one was jumping past, it looked at me, and it stumbled and fell over. It's the first time I was seeing a kangaroo not hopping properly. And it looked to me, and it didn't need to have any powerful meditation to read its mind. It sort of was saying to me, you never saw that, did you? It was embarrassed. But instead of being hiding embarrassing moments in one's life, instead one enjoys them, shares them. It's one of the great principles of spirituality. What happens when you are wise? You realize you don't have to be faultless to be perfect. You can make mistakes and you laugh at them. You can do things not quite the right way, but still, there's no blame. There's a wonderful sense of learning, human beings in this world. And when one does make a decision to jump this way, to jump that way, to do it in this particular manner or some other particular manner, I always mention that so many people are just so afraid of making decisions in life. Why? Why are you afraid of making decisions? You get as much information as you possibly can, and it's limited, the amount of information. And you know, there is never any right decision or wrong decision, it's just a decision, that's all. So you make it, and then afterwards, it's what you do afterwards, that's where the interesting part of decision making is. You learn, you grow, and you make whatever decision you made, you make it work. For those who became anagarikas, novices, monks, or samaneris, that's female novice monks, or full bhikkhunis, you make it work. In other words, you don't look back, oh, that was a good decision, not a good decision. It's past and you can't assess it. In fact, you can't assess much in this world anyway. All you do is just you make it work. You learn from it, you grow from it, and you rejoice in it, you cherish it, and you celebrate your life. not with the blame. And there are sometimes some of the beautiful experiences you have when you're actually looking for the beautiful part of life and the happy moments of life. And when it's something wrong, something you do which is not quite correct, you just tell everybody and just learn from it and keep on going. But one of the things which I was actually mentioning this to the monks on Wednesday, just because one of the we had a few car problems the last week, and I just was telling the monks that once, many years ago, I was one of the number two monk in Bodhinyana Monastery, and just with the driver, we just went to the post office in Byford. And at that time, the post office was on the main road, the South West Highway, what they call in UK a dual carriageway, two lanes on either side, and quite busy. But you could still park by the side of the road there to go into the post office, and that's what we did. And as we parked by the side of the road, and I went into the Byford post office with the Anagarika, that's the lay attendant, we were just in the queue there waiting to be served, and somebody came in the post office and said, "Does anyone own this particular car?" And it was our car. He said, "Well, it's almost halfway to Perth." "What's happened?" Because the driver had forgotten to put the brake on. And we never realized there was a gradient on that road. And so I had to go running after it with the... And I was much thinner and healthier and faster those days than I am these days. But it's still, I'm very happy it was long ago and no one got a photograph of it. Because it would have been a bit embarrassing. And of course, what do? We tell everybody about it afterwards. In other words, we learn, we're not ashamed. It's just people just, sometimes they do those things. And we cannot feel bad about that, but we delight in it. We have fun with it. And it's a different way of looking at our life. And even when people get sick, sometimes we have fun with that. I always still remember this one monk many, many, many years ago when I was in Thailand. I'm not quite sure why, but this monk was always, he looked sickly. And so there was one of our fellow monks, I think he had a typhus fever, it wasn't me. But so he was this senior monk who was asked to take him into the hospital. So there's one monk there who had a fever, like scrub typhus. He was really quite sick, and this other monk who was quite healthy, but the nurse took one look at these two monks, and he put the senior monk, the healthy monk, in the wheelchair. And he had to say, "It's not me, I'm healthy, it's this fellow next to me." But anyway, that's how he looked. So, when you have fun with life, whatever happens, you can always find joy anywhere. And I just want to, just this afternoon, I received a lovely email. And you know, from the nun Venerable Chanda over in UK, because she'd been sent this from one of her supporters over in Germany, who's a doctor working in the ICU, and one of the people that she was looking after was a lady who had, I think, some pneumonia from COVID-19 patient. And said this doctor was surprised, but so pleased. The one book which this COVID-19 patient had in a hospital in Germany was my book. The German version of Open the Door of the Heart, which is the Kuh der Weinte, the cow that cried. That was the translation I used. And she said that, you know, even though she had pneumonia and has intubation, I think they called it, so many tubes inside of her in order to, you know, keep her alive, she still managed to read some of those silly stories. And so those wise stories, some of those little examples over there, to keep up a happiness level, a joy level, so that was, you know, part of her therapy, She said, please say thank you to Ajahn Brahm for writing that book and having it translated into German. So all those little things, that they bring me lots of happiness and joy, that, you know, they actually serve. And why are they serving? Why is a person in the ICU having a book like that next to them? Because it encourages, inspires, uplifts them. It's so easy, you know, in a world where we do have difficulties and problems, to actually too get negative. And that sort of negativity, especially in some of the hospitals in our modern world, that negativity can all just be so sickly. But I also remember seeing today, because I do on the internet look at the ABC news site, and they had a hospital there in Melbourne apparently, and they were just dancing and singing in the wards. And it made me really laugh when I saw one of the, I don't know who they were, medical assistant or a doctor or a nurse, so dancing to this tune with a skeleton. In other words, they're bringing some happiness and joy, you know, into their, you know, terrible, like COVID-19 situations. And that happiness and joy, that laughter, makes us so much difference, seeing the good in the world. Because once you start seeing the good in the world, not looking for the bad stuff, but seeing the joy which sometimes people have, they get to read good books in the ICU, they manage to have a bit of singing and dancing. Some of those old doctors, they weren't good dancers, even I could recognize that, but nevertheless they were having a go. And seeing people just, you know, cracking a few jokes, whatever, that actually brings a lot of extra energy into difficult situations. And I've seen that so many times in my life, that when there is sort of a crisis, when there is some difficulty, a funny joke, a funny anecdote can help enormously. Allow people not to obsess with the negativity in life, but to see something much more deep, to see things from another way, another angle, which is one of the reasons why that joy is not just fun and games. It's a way of changing our attitudes to what is happening in our life, seeing things from a different angle. And then once we can start seeing that joy in even the difficult situations in life, even in like death and dying. So we all get old. We know sometimes how old. I remember this this guy, he was, as you can see, this, I haven't told a joke so far today. There's one coming. This guy, he was actually 70 years of age. And he married this very, you know, he's quite wealthy. And he married this very, very young woman. And his friend said, how did you get to marry her? Did you lie about your age? He said, yeah, I lied about my age. I told her I was 90. Okay, I hope that some of you might get that joke. I know that sometimes people watching online, they sometimes have to explain the jokes online if people don't get them. But anyway, I'll explain it, because if you're 90, you're going to die soon and you're wealthy. So that's actually why the girl married her. But, you know, the friend said, oh, you're only going to say you are 50 or 60. Okay, when I've explained that one now, so I can pass it on and go forward to something else. I hope people don't sort of, because sometimes my jokes, sometimes that people, they're said with like a good spirit behind them, just, you know, trying to enjoy some of the silliness of our lives and just how we react to our lives. There's nothing mean or nasty in them anywhere. So anyway, going back to bringing joy in one's life and a bit of happiness, once you can do that in one's life, you know, as a monk, you know, we haven't got much in our life. As a monk, I just got my cave. But, you know, if anyone goes in the cave, you know, there's a bat still in there. I think it's my third bat. It's not the other ones flew away. It was that people decided to auction them. Auction a bat? but actually raised lots of money for the Nuns Monastery and for Jhana Grove and other places. So the bat did a lot of good karma. But I've got another bat in my cave now. It's very, very happy being in that cave. And people sometimes visit that cave and they say, what's a bat doing in there? And if you look at it, it's so still. It's only, I think it was from IKEA or somewhere. It's so still, I say, it's meditating. And anyway, a lot of times people think, yeah, okay, Ajahn Brahm's gone crazy. I haven't gone crazy, I was crazy a long time ago. But not, but not that type of crazy. Crazy in the sense of like seeing the fun in things, and the joy in wherever you live. And once you see the joy and happiness in wherever you live, it changes again one's attitude to whatever happens. I always was, I said, a bit disappointed that when COVID-19 started and we had lockdown, I thought no one would be able to come into monastery to feed the monks. And I thought for once I'd have an opportunity to lose some weight. Unfortunately, you never let me do that. You continue to bring food to feed me. Oh, well, I suppose that's my karma to be, I think I won't call it fat. I call it to have gravitas, which is important for a senior monk. But anyway, well, what was that time that here, I think it was Chinese New Year time, some time ago, a few years ago, I was standing just by the entrance to the reception room. I was standing there talking to somebody, minding my own business, and an elderly Chinese lady came by. She wasn't a regular to this center. She came by, stopped, took one look at my stomach wrapped in monk's robes, and started to rub it for good luck. You're not supposed to rub a monk's belly. But she was grinning on all over her face. And so I thought I'd laugh as well. So I laughed. It's very rare having your belly rubbed as a monk. So don't get any ideas, you know, the few AV workers who are listening to this. But anyway, that sometimes, how do you react to the unexpected experiences of your life? You've got choice. You can laugh with it, or you can feel embarrassed, ashamed, angry. There's too many people get angry. And because they get angry and negative, it increases the mistakes of that moment. If you laugh, it takes that moment, somebody made a mistake, you explain it to them afterwards, but they enjoyed it. They realize that spiritual teachers are kind and wise. We don't want people to come here and do something wrong and feel they're really, really embarrassed and never want to come back again. If they make a mistake, thank you. It makes for another funny story. But it's also sometimes important stories. Because I'm sitting here in this hall and it's mostly empty, I also remember that time when just over to my right at the back, during the meditation, which was a nice quiet meditation period, one woman lay down with her feet pointing towards the Buddha. That was okay. She didn't do that out of disrespect. And as she lay down, she started snoring quite loudly. And the people sitting next to her woke her up. And I thought, why did you do that? Because that woman had talked to me earlier. I knew who she was. She was not a regular at this venue, but she was someone who just had a little interview with me before. It was many years ago. She was a victim of domestic violence. going through a terrible, terrible, terrible time at home and hadn't slept for days. So can you imagine what it must, well, imagine if you possibly can, a fraction of what it must feel like. You're afraid, so afraid, you can't let yourself sleep. Or sleep for a few minutes and then wake up because you hear some sound. This was many years ago. Obviously these days there's many other things she could have done. But she came in here and this place was safe. She said afterwards it's the first time she felt protected in weeks. So she lay down and fell asleep. Just her body told her to. It wasn't that she'd done something wrong. It wasn't that she'd done this on purpose. She was a wounded individual who needed just a little time. And snoring is not that much sound. You know, sometimes there's some motorbikes in the back. There's people who just have their desire to do their to mow their lawn at the meditation time. There's always noise around. But when we don't fight the noise, we understand the noise and realize a person needed to snore. It's not a problem at all. But anyway, it was just those occasions there when instead of like fighting the world, we learn how to understand the world and be kind to the world and kind to the people who that's the best they can do. And when you find a little bit of joy and fun in what happens, so another time when somebody was meditating and they fell asleep, and this was an anecdote from the time I used to teach in one of the top security jails here in Perth. And it was such a very violent jail that you always had to have a prison officer with you at all times, even during the meditation session. So during this meditation session, this prison officer was there with about six or seven other prisoners in a little room next to the schoolroom. And there I started leading the meditation, and after about 5 or 10 minutes I heard somebody start snoring. I ignored it for the first 1 or 2 minutes, but then something told me I should open my eyes, and I did. The person who had fallen asleep was a prison officer, and one of my so-called trusted disciples. His fingers were about maybe half an inch from the officer's keys. He was about to take the keys off the prison officer. And I opened my eyes and he looked at me, I looked at him. Without saying a word, I gave him a look of silent disapproval, which he understood straight away. He put his hand away. And then afterwards he said, that was really a close thing, Ajahn Brahm. If I didn't respect you and like you, I'd have had those keys. But anyway, we laughed about that afterwards. Whenever we do anything which is a little bit a mistake or a close problem, again, it's much better to see some fun and joy in it rather than anything else. Because when we do that, we learn that when we make mistakes, that we can see the joy in it, the fun in it, rather than just tell other people, or rather hide it from other people. It's one of those reasons why that we have things called precepts in Buddhism, rules of we're supposed to follow. Now, one of which the Buddha said was one of the core rules, was the rule of not lying, of being honest. Why is it that people lie? And for many, many, many times, you know, I tried to teach, look, don't think about, oh, if you lie you're going to be punished, or you're going to have a bad rebirth afterwards, and stuff like that, because that doesn't really work for many people, and instead just to say, well, why do people lie? What's the reason for it? No, so not sort of telling the truth out of fear, but learning how to tell the truth because there's no fear. So why do people lie? And a lot of times it's because telling the truth has worse consequences. It's one of those almost like themes behind monastic life in Buddhism. As long as one tells the truth, even if one has done stupid things, as long as one tells the truth, then it's usually the only consequence is just, so try not to do it again, off you go. If you lie though, again there's much, much worse consequences. So that's one of the reasons why when you do make mistakes, so I was trying to think of one of the great mistakes which I made years ago. And this was just after I'd taken over from the previous senior monk here, Ajahn Chakkaro. And I was just a new abbot, a new leader in this monastery. So I wanted to make sure it was led properly. So one morning, I just happened to be walking through the forest, and then I saw in the forest there was a hammer which was going rusty. Someone, it must have been one of those monks, had left the hammer outside in time when it was rainy instead of putting it away. And I thought, this is a good opportunity to tell the monks I was leading to be more mindful and more careful and not taking these things for granted. So I held a special meeting in the main hall, and I talked to the monks, not as I talk these days. I talked with a straight back. I was fierce. I was scary, because all the monks were sitting perfectly straight. And I told them that you have to be more careful. You didn't work and buy the hammer yourself. This hammer was offered by one of our followers, and all our followers are rich, and some very poor followers of this monastery, many of them are pensioners, or they're struggling just to get by, and so that I don't know who offered this hammer, but it could have been one of our poorest of supporters. I don't care, it's a hammer, it costs money. You should look after it and care for it. And if you use it out in the forest, make sure that you remember to pick it up and put it away again, and don't be so lazy and careless. This is important. It was much fiercer than that. And after the talk, I remember looking at all the monks and the novices and the Anagarikas and the visitors. All of them were quiet. Not even one of them confessed that it was them. And that really disappointed me. And I thought maybe I'd scared them too much. Maybe my presentation was just too authoritarian. Maybe they were just so afraid of the consequences. So we finished the talk and I went outside being disappointed. It's only when I went outside, I don't know why this always happens, only when I went outside, I figured out who'd left that hammer out in the forest in the rain. It was me. I left it out there. And I'd forgotten all about it. And so, it's very embarrassing, but it's good for me. I sort of went back in the hall and said, can you please sit down for just a couple of minutes? I just finally figured out who left that hammer out in the forest. I put my hand up, it was me. And all the mugs burst out laughing. It was a wonderful little anecdote. Yeah, I don't know why that is. Even though I was telling everybody off, it just went totally out of my mind that I was the one responsible for that hammer being out there. You know, I'd always meant to put it away, but something else happened, and then somebody else had a conversation with me, and you know, something else, and then I forgot about it. And I told people that one of the reasons I forget about these things is I live too much in the present moment. What do you expect? That's my excuse. Anyway, so when one doesn't worry about making mistakes, when it's not embarrassed about doing stupid things, it does mean that one is at peace with oneself. And all the mistakes of your life, all the things which you've done wrong, or you see other people do wrong, you can let them go very easily. Because you can let go of mistakes very easily, there's no point in lying. There's no reason for it anymore. You have nothing to hide. What do you want to hide in life? Mistakes, errors of judgment, embarrassing things which one did, all those sorts of stuff. But if you can't just not do embarrassing things in life, but you can admit them, not feel ashamed about them, not feel diminished that you're somehow lesser because you make mistakes. If you can accept that, it's part of loving who you are, loving this human body which makes decisions which are sometimes wrong. But you can be at peace with that. When you accept that or at peace with it, it does mean you're not ashamed of it, which means you don't have to tell lies. You're truthful. You're truthful to who you are. In your idea. And that means that when you sit down to meditate, you can let go of your past mistakes so easy. You don't need to be so afraid of your future faults. Which means that if it's like giving a public talk, you're at peace, you're not afraid. You don't have anxiety. What do you have anxiety about? Making mistakes. There's nothing wrong with making mistakes, so what are you anxious about that for? Might as well be anxious about breathing. So anyway, when mistakes are looked at appropriately in a proper way, to be learned from rather than be feared, then anxiety disappears. Fear of the future goes. Because you can make mistakes and it is not a problem. And of course, all the handling of the stuff from your past, what you did and how you did it, and whether it was right or whether it was wrong, all of that can disappear as well. Simply because you're a fallible human being. You do make mistakes. And because of that, you can admit them. And you know when you admit your mistakes, when you acknowledge them to others, to your friends, or like me in public, when you admit your mistakes like that, what happens is, a lot of times people, they give you this adjective description of being authentic, being real. Someone which people can relate to. Not being a lesser person or a lesser monk or a lesser leader, but someone who's real. Sometimes it does do a fault. Well, not this Friday, a couple of Fridays ago, I was there in my room just having a cup of tea before coming out for the 7:30 talk. And it's only about 15 minutes. And as I was having my cup of tea, a cockroach came out. Right on my arm. It's only a cockroach, they don't harm you, but it came out so quickly that I reacted to it. And I spilt my tea all over my inner robe. Ah! So I didn't admit this, but a couple of weeks ago, I had no underrobe on at all. And I was so careful to make sure my upper robe never fell down, because otherwise you would have seen my naked top body. I got away with that. That was pretty close call. It's still there somewhere. So anyway, you can stay there. I still managed to have half a cup of tea. And anyway, so when you do make mistakes, just admit them and tell people about them, and they'll find it great fun. And it means not only you don't have anxiety and guilt, but it makes it so much easier to keep your precept of not lying, of being truthful. Because we're not embarrassed about admitting our mistakes. We don't have to lie. And other people, we tell our secrets to, they understand. Yeah, you did that mistake. Yeah, I did that mistake too. And then we find this wonderful sense of ease. We're not such a flawed personality as we thought. Look at me, my robe fell off again. Anyway, it's back on there now. That's just what happens sometimes. I keep my robe pretty loose when I put it on me, especially when I meditate, because if it's too tight, it actually cuts off some of the blood supply. I remember years ago, I always used to have it very, very tight, and I used to get a pain in my neck. It was just, it was cutting off some of the blood. And so these days, I just let it fall off sometimes. It's not that bad. And also, I do that out of a lot of compassion for the other monks. So when their robe falls off, they say, well, I'm just a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. In other words, to stop people feeling as if they have to be so tight to be a good, successful monk. And somebody actually, what was that? I gave a talk once to a group of executives, really top business leaders. And one of them, they were watching me during my talk, and they said the thing which really stood out was not what I said, but actually how I behaved. And they said, we saw you, your robe was just so loose. It did fall off a couple of times, and you just put it back on again without really worrying about it. And I saw that looseness, that lack of tightness, that lack of control, really impressed me. Because they come from a very harsh and strict Catholic school where all the nuns were just wound up so tightly. And he said that's how they behaved to me. It was very unpleasant. But you, he said, you're just so loose, free, open. He said that is something which she admired much more than anything which I said. And it reminded me just when you have that looseness, that openness, the ability to allow mistakes to happen, the ability to fail, and learn, and do it better next time. If you have that type of ability, then you don't need to lie anymore. And you can keep that precept so easily. So it means that the persons, people you live with, the people you live with, they know that what you say is, how you look at life. You don't need to deceive anybody. You don't need to sort of pretend. Now, number one, that's a much, much healthier way to live, personally. It would be terrible if I had to fake it every time I gave a talk. I give too many talks to fake anything and to pretend. There's too many monks you live with. They know what I am and how I live and everything. So, this is who I am, and just this is Ajahn Brahm. And that makes me so relaxed when I give a talk. Good talk, bad talk, whatever. But you relax. And also, you're truthful. Truthful to yourself, truthful to life. which means that when I close my eyes to meditate, then you don't try and pretend when you're meditating either. You just relax into this moment. I was just telling that to one of the monks about how to meditate. Sometimes I never call it focusing or concentration, that's the last word I use. Say the relaxing, really relaxing just so deeply. And you can only relax if you're truthful to this moment. You don't hide anything, you don't reject anything. You're in this moment and you open the door of your heart to this moment exactly as it is. It may not be what people call perfection, what people expect as purity. But when you accept it with love, with kindness, it turns into something very pure and very beautiful. It's not what you're experiencing, but how you experience it. If you want something, you're trying to control it and make it into some image of perfection, or you'll just stress out even more. You never find peace in your life, especially in your meditative life. But if you learn how to accept this moment, honestly, be truthful to it, not be afraid of it. Accept it totally. In other words, not control it with wanting. Not denying it with delusion. Not being afraid of it or rejecting it with ill will. The main reasons for lack of peace, the three poisons of wanting, ill will and delusion, have just been taken away. The cause of suffering is being removed. And your mind becomes peaceful. Such a simple, simple way. And it works. It's how I meditate. And soon, when you accept this moment, honestly, the mind becomes at peace. It becomes really at peace. Deeply at peace. Magnificently at peace. Intensely at peace. Intensely? Yeah, that's, I think, a good word. Because when things focus, it's like all the energy of your mind comes into one point. Brilliant, beautiful, blissful, powerful. All coming from just relaxing. Sometimes people mistake, they think relaxing is just being irresponsible. Not doing the duties. You're going to waste too much time. You don't waste time when you relax. It goes so deep, your body just so peaceful it vanishes. The breath so at ease that it disappears too. Bliss, joy, power, all comes from relaxation, from contentment, from stillness. So that's the talk for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. So now we have the questions. And while the questions are coming on the computer, just one little announcement if you haven't looked at it on the BSWA website. The next week we have Ajahn Nisavano is going to come and do the Friday night talk and the Saturday afternoon meditation. But in the meantime, you see that I pressed the wrong button. Help, come back. Everyone's been deleted. We don't call it everyone's been deleted, they've all gone to Nibbana. Can you get it back again? Yeah. You see, I'm honest to my mistakes. Okay, here we go. From Indonesia, the Netherlands, Japan and France. That's nice. How do we face a controlling relationship? My partner is caring, but she gets angry if I don't follow what she says. You can't always follow what she says, no matter
how much you try. So she can't be caring and angry. So your partner gets angry if I don't follow what she says. I know sometimes that I get people, I don't call them controlling, I call them manipulative. In other words, they ask me to do this and they ask me to do that. And I'm only one monk and there's only so much I can do in my day, in my life, and I can't get too worn out. So for years ago, I found out these skillful means. When someone sort of asked me to follow this and do that, if I say no, oh, that really gets angry. So instead I say, I'll think about it. Now I know I'm really putting myself in a big, terrible position here because there's a few of the workers here who are allowed to come in for this talk. And they've asked me so many times to do this and to do that. And I always say, well, yeah, maybe it's a good idea. No, leave it with me. I'll think about it. And I'm not lying, because some of these invitations or requests I've been thinking about for the last 10 years. There's a much better way than saying no. And it's honest, because I still think about it. So, why is it controlling? What's she afraid of? Because sometimes we only want to control when we're afraid that, you know, you may sort of disappear or you may sort of find another partner in life instead of her. So she's caring, she's showing that side of her. So what I would do, and of course, if ever you want any advice about relationships, especially family relationships, you should always ask a monk. I've been celibate for the last 46 years, so sometimes what would I know about relationships? But nevertheless, people ask me, so I say, open my mouth and say something. So, if she is caring, that's something in her which is very beautiful. So, always mention that to her. You know, you're so caring, thank you so much, you care so much. And see if that part of her will grow. And the controlling, when you don't follow what she says, and you say, oh, maybe I misunderstood what you said. Or, but you know, don't say that until after you've done what you wanted to do. So, little by little, that relationship will grow where there's more trust. So she's not afraid of letting you do what you think you should do. So it's fascinating just teaching in a monastery for such a long time. And you know, sometimes that, you know, I did a lot of building in those early years and I realized you can't always do building work, even though today I was on scaffold this morning. Should I tell you that to you? Because people always tell me off, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't be on scaffold, you're too valuable to fall off. So I didn't fall off, so it's okay. So. Please may the Committee of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia not have a controlling relationship to me, even though you care about me. So, why do people want to control? What are you afraid of? And when you find out that what one controls because one is afraid of something, afraid of losing something. So if you want to find out why your partner controls, what is she afraid of? And when they find out you've got nothing to fear, we don't need to control. We can be much more relaxed, at ease. And the things which we were afraid of losing, we will never lose. Anyway, from the Netherlands. I struggle with situation where it is clear beyond a doubt the person lies and does unjust actions. I get entangled, how not to? It's the best that don't allow other people's actions to control your actions. In other words, if a person lies and does unjust actions, usually that's the case where the law eventually sort of gets involved. And you know, sometimes that's one of the best ways there, because it makes it very clear to that person that what they're doing is unjust and is lying. If it's small things, then their lies and unjust actions will probably mean they won't have many friends. Because would you like to be with a person you can't trust? Oops. Don't trust me with these machines. Okay. With a person who lies or does unjust actions. Again, that's one of the wonderful benefits of living in a monastery, because people don't lie there. So when somebody says something, you know that's what they mean. And I never realized just that that's not the way of the normal world. Until one of my old school friends came to visit. This is years ago when I was still a monk in Thailand. He came to visit our monastery in Thailand, and I made sure he was set up in a nice little room, and he was tired from the journey. And I said, oh, even though you're tired, it'd be wonderful if you could get up early tomorrow morning, because we go on the alms round in the village. And it's something which you don't sort of have in London, and it's unmissable. And he said, but I'm young, I can't get up that early in the morning. I said, oh, it doesn't matter, just 10 minutes beforehand, I'll come to your room and I'll knock on the door to wake you up. Which I did. And he quickly got dressed and went to the toilet, and then we went on the alms round together. But on the way back from the alms round, he said something which I will never forget. And his name was Keith, if he's listening to this. But anyway, he said to me, he said it was a very unique feeling the night before. When you said that you'd be at my door the following morning to wake me up, I knew you'd be there. And he said, in London, sort of people make all these promises and I can't trust them at all. I have to set alarms or make other arrangements just in case. But when you said that, I knew you'd be there. He said, that was so strange. And I didn't realize that many places in the world people make promises, they lie, they are unjust. But in communities like monasteries, or I hope the Buddhist Society in Western Australia and other really good communities, we value that truthfulness so much that we won't break promises. You know, if we can't fulfill the promise, we'll tell the person, look, I can't come tomorrow morning, please make other arrangements, but I'm going to try my best. Again, that's all part of lying. That Ajahn Chah reminded me of this too many times, that it's really branded into me now, that if you make a promise, you have to keep it. If you just make a promise too loosely, it's almost the same as lying. You don't mean to keep that promise. That's like the same as deceiving somebody with your words. So sometimes I don't make promises easily. I'll say I'll think about it. But if I do make a promise, I'm going to keep it as best I possibly can, unless it's impossible to keep. So that means that there is the honesty there. Which is a wonderful place to live, but if you're living in a place where people aren't honest, or like in a company or an office or something, you try and don't get affected by it, and just remember your own honesty, your own goodness, your own trustworthiness. Other people in your company will see that in your office or whatever your work of life is, and they will value that. That's certainly what happened to me when I was teaching in prisons. When teaching in prisons, because I was honest and kind, even though many other prisoners weren't honest and certainly were violent, I always felt very safe. And the prisoners who used to come to my classes always said that, you're very safe in this place because you're honest and kind to us. So we'll never allow anyone to harm you. Can't that happen in an office or a company? Prove your goodness, prove your honesty, just show it day after day, week after week. Don't argue with a person because they're lying or they're unjust. You be just, you be honest, you be kind. That's all you can do. from Japan. My loved one received a terminal cancer diagnosis. He has a few months left. How do I come to a sense of peace so I can make the best of the time we have left? You know, sometimes it's a wonderful thing. Because we're all going to die one day, but when you actually hear that someone, the cancer is terminal, you've got some idea of the time which has left. It makes these last days so important, so beautiful, so wonderful. Because you know that, well, you should have known all along from the time you married them, that all the relationships, they are temporary. 30 years, 40 years, 60 years. There comes that ending point. And one of the most beautiful things when you do have a partner you love very much and it comes very close to their end is make sure they will go with your permission, with your blessings. And don't just look at, you know, what happens after death. Look at all you've had together, it's a beautiful life you've lived together. So many wonderful times and memories. You look at the big picture, just rather the moment of death. And you say, what a wonderful time we had together, thank you so much. And if you are a Buddhist, you know there is such a thing as reincarnation, rebirth. And if you really, really, really want to meet together again another time, you can make that resolution. Maybe meet again, another place, another time. Why is it that people just fall in love, just love at first sight? It's not first sight. You know, it's here we go again. But anyhow, that he has a few months left. How do I come to a sense of peace so I can make the best of the time we have left? You realize that this is always life. A few months left. Enjoy them. And the most important thing to do is to know the greatest act of love is to let somebody go with your blessing. Which is one of the reasons why when people are very sick, when they are close to death, I always make sure that they say to the people they love, it's okay, you can die. Die with my blessing. The greatest act of love is to give permission for someone to go. You don't want them to be in that old body suffering from some terrible cancer. Life without value. So give them your permission. You can go with my blessing. I love you so much that I give you that freedom. And it becomes a very beautiful time. And of course, when it's gone, when the person passes, then you know that those last days, months, were very well spent. Not being angry or upset or afraid, but being honest. Open the door of your heart to the fact that we all must pass one day. And you are, in one that sense, fortunate. They have some idea of the time they have left. You have this few months, an intense course of love, allowing the person to be. And when they do die, don't cry, if you possibly can. The tears were for you. You're crying for your own loss. You're not crying for them. Once that cancer is gone, then they're free. From France, what do you do about people who try to make you feel guilty or bad about a mistake or voicing a truth? Oh, people can try and make you feel guilty, but you'd be stubborn. You know, you've told a truth. You know, you made a mistake. You say, well, I learned from it. And if people try to make you feel guilty, what's the purpose of guilt? Guilt doesn't make you a better person, just guilt makes you more skillful at hiding things from the future. It's one of those parts of life which I just don't agree with, and which was one of the reasons why I chose Buddhism as my path. You looked through all these
teachings of the Buddha, and I never found guilt. You know, people wanting to punish themselves because they made some sort of fault. Guilt was not part of the repertoire of a Buddhist. It wasn't on the menu. And that was actually quite shocking for me, but very beautiful. It was also the same as over in Thailand, that when somebody died, the family never mourned. Loss was separated from grief, and grief wasn't there. It was communities were much more real to life. Death happened all the time, and they accepted it and made peace with it. Guilty, mistakes happen all the time. We learn from them instead of overreacting to them. Anyway, that's people who try to make you feel guilty or bad about a mistake or voicing a truth refuse to be controlled by others. Okay, that's all the questions I have on here, and it is getting a little bit late now. And so, for those of you who have been listening, thank you so much for listening. And for those of you who want to ask some more questions, often on the Saturday afternoon meditation from 3 o'clock to 3:15 is a little talk, 3:15 to 4 o'clock is a meditation. From 4 o'clock sometimes I answer questions maybe to almost 5, I think, last week. But anyway, I'm very happy to answer questions about meditation, some of these other parts of life, on Saturday afternoon. That's tomorrow. So before we go, I will give a little blessing for you, as become my habit of late, because I enjoy it. It's my fun, but it's also a blessing for everyone who's listening. Sabaroga vinimuto Sabba santa povajito Sabba vera mati gando Niputo chatu wang bawa Sabiti o viva Chantu sabba rogo We not